This is an interview of Frank Towers, done by Evan Noe, N-O-O-E, and it was done March 15th, 2005. Catalog number, World War II, 17.
Well, where were you born?
I was born in Boston, Mass, 1917.
Okay. Did you have any family that was in the military?
No. None that I know of.
Okay.
My father was never in the military, and I didn't have any brothers or sisters, and I had an uncle who was in the Canadian Army, but that's all military.
Okay. What did you do right before you joined the National Guard?
I was going to school at the University of Vermont in 1936 to 38, and I left the university then to take employment there in Burlington, Vermont. The clouds of war were developing then, and one was not able to get reasonably good employment. You could not advance unless you had your prior military training. This is when the draft had come out and was requiring all young men to have 1 year of military training. So unless you had this year of military training, companies weren't enthusiastic about hiring you and training you for 6 months and then losing you to the military. So I decided then to get into the military and get my year's training over with and then come back and finish school and get some kind of reasonable employment.
What year was that you started the training?
I'm sorry?
What year was that you started the training?
1940. I joined the National Guard in Vermont in December of 1940, and we came down here to Camp Landing out here at Star, and I spent my year training there, and we were getting ready to go home in December in January of 42, but in December of 41, Pearl Harbor erupted. Then of course we were in for the duration.
What was training like?
Well, it was different because our division was from the north. We were from New England, and being transported down here into the south, the culture was entirely different. The weather, the climate was entirely different to us. And of course, the summer heat was very devastating to us. We never saw or heard of heat at 100 degrees. And the humidity, and crawling around in the snake-infested woods out there, Camp Landing. This is a whole new experience to us Yankees, as we were called out here at that time.
Before you joined, what did you think of what was happening in Europe with them?
Thinking back now, it's kind of difficult to recollect my feelings at that time, but we knew there was a war going on in Europe since 1938, and we knew a little bit about it, but not as much as I had learned after we got into service and became more militarily oriented. As to the reason for our training and the reason for the possibility of the impending war.
Okay. You said you were in training actually when Pearl Harbor occurred?
Correct.
So basically what happened the day after?
Well, at that time we were appalled to think that the Japanese people attacked us at Pearl Harbor. And that made us all the more gung-ho to go to war and to fight the enemy, whoever it may be. And of course, at that time, it was the Japanese, and we thought this was a very atrocious act on their part, and we were going to mobilize and retaliate.
Were you anticipating going to the Japanese theater?
Originally, yes. That was the immediate thought that came to our mind because Japan had attacked us, not Germany. And so our continued training went on, but about that time, Germany sided with Japan and Italy. They became the Axis powers. So the as time went on, the Germans were trying to intercept our shipping to England because we were supporting England to prevent any kind of an invasion into the British Isles. The Germans were sinking a lot of our shipping out there. We had submarines off the coast of Florida here, patrolling the waters because there was a great number of ships coming from the Gulf of Mexico where they're transporting oil around the Florida and up the East Coast to New York and then over to England. And they were trying to sabotage those oil tankers. And so in doing that, this drew us into the war. And sinking the ships in the North Atlantic, a lot of our American lives were lost, as well as the ships and the cargo that we were sending over to England. So that drew us closer to a European war than it did to the Japanese war.
Did you feel that going to Europe was somewhat of a missed opportunity to get retaliation against the Japanese, or did you see them both as?
No, we saw it kind of from both angles, that the Japanese were a threat to us on the east coast, on the west coast, and the Germans were a threat to Western Europe and the British Isles and further shipping in the North Atlantic. So both sides were pretty much equal in our ideas of whether we went to either theater, we were going to be doing our job of fighting an enemy.
Did training change anyway significantly after Pearl Harbor?
No, it didn't change. It became more intense. During the year that we were here, we were doing basically daily training, like an 8-to-5 job. After Pearl Harbor, we went on a 24-hour basis. And so training was much more intense.
What would it consist of?
Well, of course, with the infantry tactics, how to attack the enemy, bayonet training, rifle practice, target practice. We just intensified our training in all aspects of tactical training.
When did you learn that you would be sent overseas?
Well, it's hard to say just when we learned that we're going to go overseas. I was with the 43rd Division here at Camp Blanding. And they were shipped in February of 42 to Camp Shelby in Mississippi. And they were on their way to the Pacific at that time. They went from Shelby, Mississippi to Fort Ord, California, and then they shipped out to the islands in the Pacific. While we were at Camp Shelby, I was taken out of the unit and sent to Fort Benning for training at the Officer Candidate School. And I spent 3 months there. So my chances are of going overseas during that period was nil. Many of the the graduates of my class were sent immediately over to Africa. I don't know of any of them that went to the Pacific, but a number of them went directly to Africa, joining the American troops in the invasion there in Africa. But I was fortunate and was not sent over there. I was sent to Camp Wheeler up near Macon, Georgia, and I spent 14 months training recruits at that camp. After the 14 months there, I was transferred to Camp Atterbury in Indiana, where I joined the 30th Infantry Division. And we trained at Camp Atterbury during November and December of 43, January of 44, still not knowing where we were going to go. We felt sure that we were going to go overseas, but we didn't know if we were going to go to the Pacific or to Europe. When we were leaving Camp Atterbury on the 1st of February, they issued us summer suntan uniforms, which indicated right there we're going to the Pacific. While we're moving on the train in the next couple of days, we felt we were going eastward. And we determined from the signs that we could see along the way that yes, we're going east, we're not going to the Pacific. But why did they give us these uniforms? So we ended up in Boston, and they took those summer uniforms away from us and gave us wool uniforms. So we knew pretty much then that we're going to be going to Europe. And from that point on, there was no doubt that we were going to go to Europe.
When did you depart for England?
We left Boston on the 12th of February, 1944, and landed in Scotland on the 22nd of February. We went by train down through, this was in the area of Glasgow, is where we landed, and we were down by train to London and then to the south coast of England, and that's where we stayed most of the time until the invasion actually occurred.
Did you receive additional training?
Oh, we were training all that time. We were receiving updated intelligence information as to where the enemy was, what the units were that we were going to be fighting against, what their disposition was, the kind of weapons that they had. And we were pretty well prepared for going into Europe against the enemy.
What was it like waiting?
Not knowing exactly what combat was. You see it in the movies, but you can't visually or physically know what it feels like. We're very anxious. Anticipating, we've got to go. Let's hope we go tomorrow. We're going to go across the channel and we're going to fight the Germans. And when we get there, then the war is going to be over. We're going to whip them all. But it wasn't quite that easy. We didn't know what we're talking about really. When you move in there and you're facing actual enemy fire, it's a whole different situation than when you're out in the field here practicing with dummy ammunition or knowingly firing over our heads. You know you're safe. But once you get over on the continent, there was no place that was safe.
What was your position? Did you have like a specialist position or?
When we arrived in Europe?
Yes.
When we went across the channel, I was a mortar platoon leader in a heavy weapons company. I was an M company of the 120th Regiment. But due to circumstances, I was delegated to be a liaison officer between the battalion headquarters and the regimental headquarters. The duties of a liaison officer were more or less a glorified messenger boy, but it was a necessary position because as the front lines were moving forward, the rear headquarters had to know where they were at all times. Our signal company and radio people would try to keep in communication with the front lines as best they could, but sometimes that distance would be extended where the radios wouldn't reach. There may be a hill or a mountain in between, so the radio couldn't get through. The telephone lines yet hadn't been laid. If the telephone lines had been laid, the tanks maneuvering around ran over those telephone lines and cut them up. So there was never any assurance of clear communication between the front line and the headquarters. So this is my job to keep in contact with the front lines and the battalion headquarters, so they would know what the front line was doing at all times. And then also to carry them plans for the attack for the next day.
Were you reassigned fairly quickly once you entered Europe from
the border? Yes, I was, because that kind of position was not in the table of organization at that time. They didn't know that they were going to need such a position. But as the situation developed, they determined that the radio could not keep up good communication. The telephone lines were not reliable. They had to have somebody to do this message relay constantly. So it was a 24-hour-a-day job relaying messages back and forth from the front line back to the battalion headquarters.
I read in your memoirs that you arrived on the 12th of June.
Well, we loaded up at the on the ships on the night of the 12th, and we landed on the 13th. Yeah.
What was your first impression as you were approaching the continent?
Well, of course, my first impression was we're in the wrong place, because we got into a packet of boats allegedly to be routed over to Omaha Beach. And we had been trained or told there was a narrow beach, and then there were cliffs, and there was a small draw or a ravine there, and this is where we were going to land, and we had to go up through that ravine, and then we start our attack a mile or two inland. But somehow this packet went over to Omaha, to Utah Beach, and here we had a very broad, sandy beach. There were no cliffs, there was no ravine, and that beach was still under artillery and mortar fire, which Omaha Beach was not under fire. And so we knew that we were in the wrong place. In fact, after we landed, the beach master advised our battalion commander that you're on the wrong beach. You belong over at Omaha Beach. So we had to reboard on the ship and sail over to Omaha Beach. So actually, our coming into Utah Beach was like landing in a foreign place. We had not been told about this flat beach and no cliffs. So it was kind of a surprise that we were on such an open area.
What was your initial assignment once you landed?
That's when I became the liaison officer. I had been a platoon leader of the mortar platoon, but as soon as we got there, there was no guide to lead us up to where the regiment, see, the regiment had come in before, so it was the part that was on the right ships that they had gone to Omaha Beach, and they had gone inland about 5 miles. So it was my job immediately then, I was assigned this job, to go and find where the regiment is and come back and then take our battalion to that spot. So that's where the liaison officer position develops right there.
Okay. So you basically did that until the end of
until the end of the war, yeah.
Okay.
Later on, I became a division liaison officer, doing the same work, just at a higher level.
What was your first engagement with the Germans like?
That was around the 20th. We first had combat. Our first combat was on the 15th, and I guess it was around the 20th of June that I had my initial contact with the enemy.
How did you feel once that was over, after being in your first firefight?
I guess I and all the rest of us, we felt lucky to be survivors, because we didn't realize that the artillery fire was going to be as concentrated as it was, as deadly as it was, and we had some misfortunes where our own American artillery fell short, and so we were caught in between the German barrage and the American barrage, and it was a I guess a weird feeling to know that here you are fighting an enemy, but yet you're under fire from your own artillery.
Was this a set attack, or was it just a skirmish that broke out while you were advancing?
I'm sorry?
Was this a set attack? Was this something that was organized?
Oh, yes. Yeah. You know, the Germans were well organized on their defensive positions, and we were pretty well organized, too, on our attack plans to break through those defensive positions that they had.
Where was this?
In the town of St. Jean today.
Your memoirs also said you were involved in the Mortain battle.
Okay, that was a little further on. Yeah, I was involved in that. We had a we moved into Mortain like on the 2nd of August and relieved another division, the 1st Division, who had taken the town, and they were in defensive positions there. We relieved them in order that they could go further south down toward Brest with General Patton. And we had not gotten well dug into our positions when the Germans attacked. And they caught us by surprise, really. But we had a battalion up on this hill, this hill 314, and there was three German armored divisions attacked us, and they surrounded that hill, drove us out of the town, and they held that position for 5 days. So that battalion remained up on that hill without any resupply of any kind. Nobody could get up to them. They couldn't carry them food, couldn't carry them ammunition. They were completely cut off. So they had to survive up there for 5 days.
During that time, you had been pushed out of the town?
Yeah, the battalion, the regiment had been pushed out of the town, yeah.
Okay. The liaison duties that you did, were you traveling by yourself?
No, I had a Jeep driver. I was not allowed to drive. I had a Jeep driver, and I always had two guards with me, because most of that time I was carrying secret information. And had we been ambushed and any attempt made to capture us, I had to have some kind of protection to keep those documents from falling into the hands of the enemy.
Did anything like that ever happen?
No.
No?
Came close. Came close a couple of times. We missed a road, and we drove on through an area that had not been officially liberated, and we learned after a short time that we were in German territory, and we turned around and got out of there.
Were there German troops, or was it just what happened when you entered the still German occupied territory?
Well, luckily there was no Germans right in that particular area at that time, and we were able to turn around and get out of there without getting fired on them. But when you're down that close to the front, any movement at all, the Germans are going to fire on you.
Did you have any downtime? I mean, was it constant just going back and forth between headquarters? Or did you have days off?
Well,
or?
I had a colleague that was doing this identical work. There were two of us that were working constantly together. And when there was a lull in the battle, one of us would have a little time off, and we could move to a back area for maybe a half a day. But no real time off to say, hey, I'm going to go to Paris, or I'm going to go to Marseille or somewhere for 2 or 3 days. There's no such thing as that. It was a matter of hours that you could go back and have a rest for a few hours.
So in your position, you would never, I know with some of the like frontline troops, they would be somewhat cycled through at times. You would never have that in your position?
No. No, the frontline troops, they would have a company broken down into platoons and squads, and those would be up in the front line, and after the end of a day, they'd be rotated back, and another squad or platoon would take their place, and they were continually leapfrogging or rotating the frontline troops all the time. But we had nobody to rotate with.
How was it like dealing with civilians, with French and Belgian civilians?
With the French people early on in Normandy, we didn't have much contact with them at all, because the Germans drove them back away from our advance, because they did not want the French people talking to us and telling them where the German emplacements were, because the French lived around there. They knew where all the Germans were living. They knew where their emplacements were, so they didn't want them to talk to us. So they kept pushing them back. So we had very little contact with them until along in about August, before we had any real opportunity to speak with the French people, you know, basically on a friendly basis. And we still had to be very cautious, because the Germans had occupied this land for 4 years. They had become friends with the French people. The soldiers had married the French girls. So therefore, you being a German soldier and you married this French girl, her father is going to be pro-German.
Did you have any partisan resistance from the French against?
No. We had very good cooperation from them. The Free French and the Partisans, they cooperated with us very, very much.
What was it like in Belgium?
It was pretty much the same. We had more contact with the Belgian people because as we were going along through the northern France, we were chasing the Germans. They had lost all contact, and they were just running back for their homeland, and just leaving rear guard actions as they went along. So they weren't pushing the Belgian people away from us. They were just going through and get out of there. So we had a lot more contact with the Belgian people. They were very receptive to having us come into their country and chase the Germans out, and so we got along with them very good.
Even with the cities closer to the German border, there wasn't any animosity towards us.
No. We went on next into Holland before we got into Germany, and I think the Dutch people were even more receptive to having us come there and liberate them. The only place we had any animosity was during the Battle of the Bulge, that December, still in Belgium, but down in the town of Malmedy, and several of the towns in that area, they had been German cities before World War I. And due to the treaties after the Treaty of Versailles, after World War I, those towns became a part of Belgium. So here's German people living in Belgium. So they were, you know, pro-German. So when we moved in there, those people were still pro-German. And but they didn't really give us any problem at all.
Okay. You mentioned with the Battle of the Bulge. When was it clear that there was this this massive offensive taking place?
Well, of course, they broke through on the I guess of the night of the 16th, 17th of December, and of course the troops in that area knew it immediately because they had the 106th Infantry Division was stretched out over a long distance, I think like 30, 35 miles, which is unusual and just not appropriate. But in that particular area, in the wintertime, it would not be feasible for an enemy to mount an attack because you're in the mountains. In the wintertime, you're confined to very narrow, winding roads. So it was a calculated risk that the Army headquarters took, that they thought, well, there'll never be an attack in this area, so we'll take this new division and spread them out and just give them a little bit of the feel of the front line, but there won't be any action there. Well, that's where they hit. And so they broke a hole through, and of course they went several miles back. Now we were up in Germany about 100 miles away, and we were alerted to move down to that area. So it took us we left it in the afternoon, all that night. Well, so it took us 24 hours. To move 100 miles, and of course where we were at Malmedy was on the northern shoulder of this bulge breakthrough, and we met up with Piper and his armored troops coming through that area. And we stopped them. We had a very heavy engagement with them and stopped them. And that was probably one of the most critical battles of the entire Battle of the Bulge. Because had Piper gone another 4 or 5 miles, he would have reached one of the biggest gasoline dumps that we had existing in Europe. And once he had reached that gasoline dump, then he could have gone on to Antwerp, which was his goal, to try to cut between the 1st and the 9th armies. But we stopped him there, and he didn't get the gas, and it was all over for him.
Okay, After the Battle of the Bulge, what was it like pushing through Germany?
It was not difficult because the troops in general had a change in attitude. They had sort of given up. And so we pushed on. They were still fighting, but not with the ferocity that they had been in France and Belgium. So it was a little bit easier. Although we still had to be very careful there in Germany because everybody was our enemy. Every man, every woman, every child. He was a German, he was a potential enemy. And we never knew. There's always good people and bad people, no matter where you go, in every civilization. And many of those people were good people. But I can't look at you and tell if you're a Protestant or a Catholic. I can't tell if you're a Nazi or a Wehrmacht or an SS. So you can't look at people and say, okay, this guy is okay, but this guy is not. Every one of them had to be treated as a deadly enemy.
Did you experience any problems with German civilian resistance?
I didn't personally know, and I don't know of anybody who did. They did not cooperate with us, but they didn't resist, to my knowledge.
What was your you were in Germany until the very end of the war?
Yeah, until the end of the war, and we stayed there until early part of August, and then we started coming back to the States.
Was there any talk of being sent to the Pacific Theater?
Oh yeah. At the end of the war, we were assigned as occupation troops, and our job at that point was military government. We had to set up, we had to find a suitable person in every town to be the mayor, the deputy mayor, the treasurer, the guy who took care of the water department, the guy who took care of the transportation. We had to set up a staff for the city and get reliable people, not these Nazis. And so this was our job at that time, getting the city staff organized so that once we left, they could start running their city the way it should be run.
Were you ever wounded at
Yes,
any point?
I was wounded twice.
How did that happen?
Well, both times just artillery shrapnel. I've got a piece right here in my cheek now. I've got a little piece of iron metal. It was never taken out and never given me any trouble, so just left it there. And I had another one in my arm, which didn't give me any problem.
Those were two separate occasions?
Sir?
Those were two separate
Yeah,
occasions?
two separate occasions, yeah.
How was it just artillery fire while you were going back and forth between headquarters
Yeah,
or?
at one time I was going down toward the front lines to contact the battalion commander, and I was actually just standing beside a tank, and down the road was a German artillery piece, and he fired and hit the front of that tank, and the artillery shell, of course, it shattered and splintered, and I just got a bunch of little splinters. I was probably 25 feet away from the tank, but just close enough that I got a bunch of splinters in my cheek there. It was nothing serious, but it's just like I had a 2 day growth of beard just stuck in all over my face there.
And what happened when you your shoulder was hit?
That one, the same sort of a situation. I was down closer to the front line, and an artillery shell come in. Just a piece of artillery shell just hit me there on the shoulder.
Did you ever Were you ever caught on the front lines having to fight?
No, not actually, no.
I guess in going back and forth, you would see a lot of the debris and just carnage left.
Oh,
I guess could you describe some of that?
What?
Could you describe some of that? Just, I mean.
Well, in one particular situation, sort of gruesome, as we were traveling along a road in Belgium, the Germans were retreating. They were out of gasoline. They would confiscate horses and cows and hook them up to their equipment to drag their equipment back. And this one particular time, I recall, is a long straight stretch of road that it was just filled with two lanes of traffic going, all horse-drawn, and our Air Force came over and they strafed that column. And they came back and they strafed it again. Well, by the time we got there, the road was just full of wagons and tanks and trucks and everything and dead horses. So we had to get our engineers up there with bulldozers and just bulldoze that stuff off the side of to the side of the road so that we could go on through. And it was kind of heartbreaking to see the Belgian civilians gathering around those horses and cutting them up and getting the meat from the horses for something to eat. They had very little food to eat. The Germans would take all their food away from them and give them just a very small daily ration. Meat, they would get might get a small amount of meat once a week. So suddenly to find a nice freshly killed horse, they would just carve it up, and within a matter of a number of minutes, they'd have that horse carved right down to the bones. And they had a lot of good meat. That was one of the things that I saw. And then later on in Germany, we would liberate some of the German prison camps where they had the Allied and British soldiers as prisoners. They had a lot of Jews prisoners, of course. And some of those, as we were coming along, the German guards on these prisons knew that we were coming, and they didn't want to get caught. So they would run on ahead and leave the prisoners on their own to their own know what I want to say, well, just on their own. And they would take delight in shooting these prisoners. And we would be driving along, we see dead prisoners all along the side of the road where the Germans had killed them.
Were these POW camps?
Yeah.
Did you come across any concentration camps?
Two small ones.
Where were they?
Near the town of Magdeburg in Germany.
I guess were they just concentration work camps, or were they death
Well,
camps?
the one I recall the most in near Magdeburg was a work camp, because it was an airplane factory and several factories that manufactured parts. And this particular camp had a number of displaced persons, people from the Poles and the Finns and the Norwegians and Russians and a bunch of Jews, all in this one camp. And a point of interest, I just happen to be going over to Germany next month and going to the city of Magdeburg. They've invited me over there to speak to them. And about a month ago, I had a phone call from a man down in Melbourne, and he wanted to know if I was with the 30th Division that had liberated Magdeburg. And he went on to tell me that he was a Jew, that he had been in a camp prison camp in Magdeburg, and I had liberated him.
Wow.
So he's going over to Magdeburg next month, and I'm going to meet him. So, you know, we're coming around full circle here. Yeah.
With the POW camps, were they comprised of both American and English and Russian?
They mostly kept the American and British together. And the Russians and the Poles, they kept them sort of in separate camps. And the Jews basically were in even a separate camp. But this particular one in Magdeburg, it was strictly a slave labor camp. I don't know of any Americans or British that were in that camp, but they were all other nationalities and some Jews.
Well, I guess, how did you deal with, I guess, the death that was there every day? I mean, just throughout the experience.
It was hard to accept the fact that your friends are being killed. And it was hard for me to believe that a man laying there was dead. He had just been killed. In fact, he was the first man that I saw that had been killed. And he'd been hit with a piece of artillery. It just cut the top of his head off, just like you took a knife and just cut it off. And he was still breathing. He was not alive, but it's a reflex action. And of course, I didn't know. I thought, well, gee, this guy's still alive and needs some medical help. And I went and got a doctor. And the doctor looked at him and saw this part of his head just completely cut off. He's gone. He did. Nothing you can do for him.
Was that on the 20th?
That was in Normandy. You know, in the very, very first days that were involved in combat. Of course, I didn't know who this man was, so it didn't affect me that much. But other times that I saw men that I knew that had been killed, it made you feel bad. And maybe my number's coming up next. You never know.
How did you feel on a day-to-day basis about being in danger?
Well, it's something that just sort of grew on you. You knew that you were in danger at all times, and that was just part of the job. You just had to accept it.
I guess what was your most intense experience there? I mean,
what
really sticks out to, do you remember the most vivid or intense?
I know in my position, I don't know that anything was any more intense than any other day. Every day was something different, but I guess the very first days of combat, this was new, having live ammunition shot at you to cope with that. I guess perhaps one of the most outstanding things that I can recall is the day that the troops on that Hill 314 at Mortain were relieved, and they came down off of that hill. I saw some of those officers and men had been up there for 5 days, and I personally knew many of them. And when they went up on that hill, there was about 900 men up there. When they walked off of that hill, a little over 300. So the 600 of those men were either killed or wounded and couldn't walk off that hill. I think that was probably the most devastating thing that I encountered.
How do memories like that affect you now?
Don't bother me now. I can talk about it, and it doesn't bother me. For the first, probably first 10 years after the war, I didn't want to talk about it. It was bad memories, and I just didn't want to relive it. So I just went about my life, and when anything came up about the war, I just ignore it. I didn't watch any war movies, or because television was new at that time. But you get with any groups of people and start talking about the war, I just turn around and leave. I didn't want to talk about it. But after 10 years, I began to realize that this was something in the past and nothing that I could change, and it didn't happen. So I began talking about it.
Do you think it was just time that helped you deal
yeah,
with that more?
Time heals all things. Now my son basically was the same way. He served in Vietnam for 2 years, and he hasn't talked about Vietnam at all. Now, just very recently, he began to talk about it, and he wants to get back with his old organization and go to a reunion and meet some of those guys and relive the war again.
How do you relate to your son with I guess his
well
experience?
We have a good relationship, but he has never wanted to talk about the war, and I've never pushed him on it because I know how I felt after the war, but I didn't want to talk about it either. So now we can talk and relate. He's never done any interviews like this, and he doesn't openly come out and start talking about what he did in Vietnam, but he and I can sit down and we can talk about it, we can relate. Because I was there and I did it, and he was there and he did it. They're entirely different wars, but you know, we can still relate.
It seems very much so like you've done a good amount of reading on World War II.
I have.
How do you feel when you're sitting there reading a book about places you were, places you were shot at, places where your friends had died?
Well, I can visualize being back there today. Of course, I've been back over there many times in the last 25 years. So I know the countryside, but when I'm reading a book about World War II, about the particular area that we were in, I can just relate with that, and I can see myself going down that road, and I can almost relive it over again.
What was it like? I saw in your memoirs you had stayed in Germany for while working at the post office, was it?
Post exchange.
Yeah.
That's when I came home, going back just a little bit, in August, after the war was over, we were in military government. We were prioritized to come back to the States and then go to Japan to finish fighting the war down there. But when we got to England, they had dropped the atomic bomb, and of course that ended the war, and then we came home. And I was home for 6 months, and then went back to Germany, and I was in Frankfurt for 3 years as the assistant post exchange officer. Yeah. But there I had a lot of contact with German people, and I never had any problem with any of them. I always found that they're reasonably nice people, and I never knew you before, and I never knew these people before, and I could sit down, I could talk with them.
There was no resentment or no.
Oh no. The people that I spoke with, that I had any dealings with, they're very thankful that we came, even though we destroyed their city, left them destitute. They had nothing. They are still thankful to be out from under the yoke of Nazism and Hitler. Because the way the thing worked over there, Hitler was in power, and unless you belonged to the Nazi Party, you couldn't get a job. Well, if you don't have a job, you can't live. So what are you going to do? You're a nice guy. You don't believe in Nazism, but you get out and you join the party. You get a job. So you live. You don't necessarily have to have the Nazism in your heart or in your mind, but the fact is, you're a card-carrying member of the party. And if you're not, you don't get a job. So most everybody, theoretically, was a Nazi, but not the die-hard Nazis that we were fighting during the war.
You went back to Frankfurt, you said?
Mm-hmm.
That wasn't, was that anywhere near any of the places you were fighting? Frankfurt's in...
No, Frankfurt was not not any area near where we had actually fought.
Did you ever go back to any of those places where you had gone through?
In Germany? Oh, yeah.
What was it like the first time you...
Well, the first time I went back to Frankfurt, see, being there for 3 years, I saw the city of Frankfurt, and they're all the same. They're totally destroyed. I went back to Frankfurt, I think, in 1984, which is 40 years for the first time. And it had been pretty much rebuilt. You could tell that the war had been fought there. There was a lot of damage. But I was back there again in the late 90s. And it's pretty much rebuilt. And you never know that there was a war fought in around the city.
Have you been back to, I guess it was Malmedy, you said? Or
yeah, I've been back to Malmedy several times, yeah. Yeah, that's all rebuilt. Now, of course, Malmedy itself is not very badly. Well, it was in the center of town. Our American Air Force actually bombed the middle of Malmedy, but that's all rebuilt, and you never know anything that ever happened there.
I guess to wrap it up, I guess how do you feel the experience changed you, or what effect it had on your life as a whole?
Well, I guess it made me older a lot faster because of the experiences that I had. But I guess it changed the course of my life because I came here from Vermont and was at Camp Landing for a year. During that period of time, I met my wife. And a couple of years later, we were married. So then after the war, I settled down here rather than back up in Vermont. So that was a big change in my life there.
What helped you get through it?
My wife. She was very supportive of me. I have had some problems after I came home. Mental and physical problems. I just had to overcome them by myself. And I can remember here, we built this house in 1950. And the naval base in Jacksonville used to fly over this area every day, very low level, practicing runs to so they wouldn't be detected by radar. And when those planes would come over, I was reliving the war, and I'd hit the ground. Now, this is 1950.
How long did that take to get over?
Between 5 and 10 years. When I hear a plane coming, I knew it was a bomber. The only thing you can do is hit the ground, make yourself get down into a ditch or something, because when the bomb explodes, shrapnel goes out and it just hits everything. So the idea is just to hit the ground and be as small a target as you can be. So it took me 5 to 10 years to get over that. Now, those planes still come over. They don't bother me at all.
Is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I think you say you have read my memoirs. Yeah. I think that pretty well covers that and what we've talked about here. I don't know much else I can add to it.
Well,
just as a, you know, the last thing that I mentioned to you about going over to Magdeburg, this is going to be a new experience for me to go back and speak to German people, whose city that, you know, I had a part in the liberation of and the destruction of this city, and to talk to them about some of my experiences around in that particular area, and then to meet this guy from down in Melbourne, I think it is, and I had a part in liberating him, because at that particular time we had all these displaced persons and prisoners that we had to get away from the front line area. This is the front line, and we had to get these people away from there. So that was one of my jobs at that time, is to escort these prisoners back 50 to 100 miles and find suitable housing for them. We found some German barracks back in this town, and so we moved this group of prisoners back into those barracks and got them food and clothing. So it'd be a reliving of that whole situation, being a part of his liberation and starting him on a new journey in a life.
Is this sponsored by the city, or is there a college there doing that?
It's sponsored by the city. Yeah. So one day, the Sunday afternoon, that they're going to have a large audience, but they said about 500 people that they want us to speak to. So that'd be unique to speak to some of my former enemies.
Are they having a lot of people come, or is it?
No, I think there's only about four people that they have invited over there.
Okay. Well, I guess that's enough for an interview.
Okay.